You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered radio with a heart from the heartland.
Yeah.
And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And welcome to Writers' Voices. Mom, you want to tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Oh, golly. This is a very interesting author here we have, A.J. Jacobs. He is the editor-at-large at Esquire magazine and the author of three New York Times bestsellers. Three New York Times. Yeah,
okay. And he will be coming to Iowa Wesleyan.
I know.
Next week in Mount Pleasant, our neighboring town, which is where Caroline lives.
Yeah.
And he'll be speaking there on March 14th, Thursday. So hopefully you're listening before that, on March 14th, 2013. And he's talking about one of his three best-selling books, which is The Year of Living Biblically. And we're also going to be talking about his more recent book today, Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. So, AJ, welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Where are you calling us from today?
I live in New York City, so I'm calling you from my apartment.
And I was just in New York City a few days ago.
Oh,
yeah,
we could have gone out for coffee.
Yeah, yeah. I was in the Soho Tribeca area mostly.
Great area.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us, AJ, what's bringing you to Iowa next week?
Well, I'll be giving a talk mostly about my book, The Year of Living Biblically. And that was a book I wrote a couple of years ago where I tried to, as the title says, live biblically. I followed all the rules of the Bible for a year. So I followed the Ten Commandments and love your neighbor, but I also followed the obscure ones, like don't shave the corners of your beard and don't wear clothes made of mixed fiber. And it was a fascinating year that actually changed my life.
Well, what prompted you to do this, other than to write a book about it?
Well, I like to immerse myself. As a writer, I sort of dive into my topics and try to live them, because I think that's one of the best ways to learn about something, is to become a human guinea pig. And I knew nothing about religion. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So it was I needed a crash course, and this is the way I decided to do it.
Well, I was reading part of that part of your book where you're talking about your visit to the Amish. See, that's where Monica's dad grew up, was in Lancaster County. We lived there for several years, and we had Amish neighbors and Amish friends, and they are an interesting people.
Yes, I mean, I love. I tried to embed myself for the book in different communities that take the Bible literally in their own way. And the Amish was one of the adventures I went on, and it was wonderful. I loved their sense of humility and simplicity. And also the guy I was staying with, this Amish guy, he was like an Amish stand-up comedian telling Amish jokes, which I did not see coming.
Yeah, what, right.
Can you repeat an example of an Amish joke?
Well, first you've got to lower your expectations. You're not going to be like rolling on the floor and laughing.
Okay. Okay.
But here's the one he told me. He said, "What happened when the Mennonite woman married the Amish man?" And the answer is, he drove her buggy. So there you go.
Now, for someone who doesn't know the distinction, Amish, of course, only drive horse and buggies, whereas Mennonites are allowed to drive cars. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Always a good sign when you have to explain a joke.
Yeah. That is true. So you set out, when you set out to do this, you knew you were going to do it for a year. Was that your plan up front?
It was. I mean, it's such a huge topic. I could have done it for 10 years, but I figured I had to write, I had to put a limit on it, or else my publisher would kill me.
And are you married? Do you have a family?
I do. I have a lovely wife, and I had one child at the time, but one of the first instructions in the Bible is be fruitful and multiply.
Right.
So I had twins during that project.
Okay.
Okay. Was there any connection here? Was
Well, you know, I take my project seriously, so it says be fruitful and multiply. I'm going to do it.
All right. So, but how did your wife handle your strange new rules of life?
Well, it was, she had a very mixed reaction. I mean, some things she really appreciated, like I became much more grateful because the Bible talks about gratitude. I think I became a bit of a better person, not a totally, I'm no saint, I'm no Gandhi, but I gossiped less and lied and coveted less. But then there were parts that drove her nuts. You know, I had to wear a, I had to have this huge beard, and she hated the beard. There are parts in the Bible that say you cannot touch women during their time of month, and even if you take Leviticus really literally, you cannot even sit on a seat where a menstruating woman has sat, because then the seat is impure, and if you sit on it, you become impure. And my wife found this offensive, so she sat in every seat in our apartment.
Now,
the stand for much of the year.
Now, how was, once that seat becomes impure, how does it become pure again?
Well, it doesn't specify in the Bible, so I just figured there was no statute of limitations. That once it was, there's no like ritual bath that you can take to cleanse the chair.
So did you? So you stood for a year?
I carried around. I bought my own little portable seat. Anyone else to sit in? That was part of it. You know, my most recent book is about health, and I learned during that year how unhealthy sitting is and how it's much better to stand. So I think my wife was actually doing me a favor, unbeknownst to me.
Ah, all right. What, other than the beard, was there anything that was obvious to other people that made you stand out or look weird?
Well, at times I did try to really get into character and actually dress like a biblical person. So there were occasions where I went out with sandals and a robe and a walking stick just to you know, sort of literally walk in the sandal steps of our forefathers. But also there are other clothing rules in the Bible. It says you have to wear fringes on the corners of your garments. So I had little fringes and tassels. And the Bible says in Ecclesiastes that you should always wear white. So I wore, even when I wasn't wearing a robe, I would wear white pants and a white shirt. So I looked like Tom Wolfe.
what would you say was the most surprising thing you learned about yourself in this process?
So many things. One I mentioned briefly, but just to expand on it, is this idea of gratitude, because the Bible says that you have to say thanks all the time. So I took this literally, and I was saying thanks for everything. You know, I'd get in an elevator, and I would be thankful that it didn't plummet to the basement. And I
yeah, that's a good. That's good.
Be thankful it went up. So it was a weird way to live, because you were saying thanks hundreds of times a day. But it also was wonderful, because you realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we totally take for granted. And we tend to focus on the four or five that go wrong. So it was a radical shift in perspective that I really tried to keep, and that has made my life significantly better.
Of course, in this country, we have so many things that, like, you turn the water spigot on and you have clean water. And, you know.
No, it's amazing.
Things we take, that we totally take for granted. Yeah. So.
Okay, let me ask you this. Did you, at the end of this project, did you draw closer to your Jewish heritage, do you think?
I did. We joined a synagogue after my year. Now, it's a Reform synagogue, and we don't really go all that often. But we did join, which is a big first step.
Uh-huh,
and I do
uh-huh.
want to teach my kids about my heritage because I want to give them a choice. So when they're older, they'll be able to decide what they want from a place of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And whether they want to be religious or not religious, it doesn't really matter to me. But I wanted to give them a little foundation. And it has made me much more open to rituals. You know, before I thought rituals were these crazy, irrational things. You know, why would someone do something that these ancient, primitive people did? But rituals can be very life-affirming, and they can be beautiful. So I've become much more open to them.
I agree with you. I think that ritual, that there is actually a sort of an inside desire in humanity for ritual, and that's really one of the primary purposes of religion.
And I agree. Yeah. And, you know, you don't have to take the rituals literally. I don't believe that Moses actually parted the Red Sea in the same way that it says in the Bible. But I still find the Passover ceremony to be very meaningful as a narrative about escape from oppression and liberation. So it really touches me. And also, one last thing about ritual is that, you know, I used to think rituals were so irrational, but even that's sort of the point of rituals. and even secular rituals are completely irrational. So if a Martian came down and saw, you know, someone doing a biblical ritual versus someone blowing out candles on top of a birthday cake, it's not like they would say, oh, this one makes sense and this one doesn't.
Right, that is true.
You know, as long as the rituals are life-affirming instead of harmful to other people, then I think they can be a wonderful way to bond with a community and your family.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is A.J. Jacobs, who's the author of The Year of Living Biblically and also Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection, and several other books. And AJ, when I looked at your history, it seems like maybe you got started in publishing with fractured fairy tales. Is that accurate?
That was one of my first books, absolutely. And that was it's not my proudest moment as a writer. That was Rocky and Bullwinkle, that great animated show in the 60s, had a segment called Fractured Fairy Tales, which is sort of taking fairy tales and doing wacky riffs on them. And I was hired to write the novelization of Fractured Fairy Tales, which I did. But I wouldn't consider it my greatest work of art.
Well, I'm interested in how you became a writer, and particularly a writer in this genre, which is mostly, I don't know, it's sort of humorous, memoir, personal essay, maybe you can tell us what genre your books actually are and how you got into that.
Sure. Well, I think what you said is sort of a mixture of humor and memoir and self-improvement, and it goes by a lot of different names. There's immersion journalism, they call it, because you, like, you know, sort of go through something and immerse yourself in a community. Or some people call it method journalism. There's stunt journalism. So there's all sorts of names for it. And I got started because I graduated with no skills whatsoever. So I couldn't get a real job. So I started doing newspaper work at a small newspaper in California. And that really taught me how to report, which I think is 90% of good nonfiction writing is reporting, just getting those details. And then after that, I wrote a couple of humor books like Fractured Fairy Tales, and then I came up with the idea for a book about reading the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z. This came about because my dad, when I was a kid, started to read the Encyclopedia, but he didn't quite finish. He made it to the middle of the letter B, like Miranda Bolivia, and I thought, well, maybe I should try to finish what he began and remove that black mark from our family history. And I love learning, I love knowledge, I love trivia, and I thought this was my intellectual Mount Everest. And that was my first foray into this genre.
Wow. So How long did it take you to read the entire encyclopedia?
It took me about a year and a half, and I was reading about 6 to 8 hours a day. I still had a full-time job, and I'm still not sure how I did that.
Whoa.
I think I was phoning it in at work. But yeah, I read all the time. I read, you know, on the subway. I read in the bathroom. You name it. I just devoured that book.
And what year was that?
That was, I believe, about 2004 or 5. And the book I wrote about it was structured chapter A, B, C, D. And it was sort of a mixture of the most fascinating facts I learned from the encyclopedia, plus the adventures I went on. Like, I went on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and I joined Mensa and went to a Mensa convention, and then also a little bit of memoir. I under F for Freud, I would talk about my upbringing and my feelings about my parents, that kind of thing.
Wow. Now, when you set out to do this, did you have a book contract, or did that come later?
I did have a book contract. I mean, I sometimes say I might have tried this without a book contract, but I think I'd still be somewhere in, like, the R's or the S's. The book contract definitely gave me motivation to finish. And what I did was I had a friend who was an editor, and I proposed the idea, and I did the A chapter. I read the A's to show him what it would look like. And that was in the proposal, and he said, you know, I think this works. Let's do the rest of the alphabet.
And how much time did he give you to do it?
About a year. I think I was, you know, I was probably a few months late with my deadline, as just trying to keep up the tradition of writers missing deadlines. I don't want to embarrass myself.
So you actually read the encyclopedia and wrote the book in that year and a half?
That's right. I was actually
pretty impressive.
As I was going along and trying to write some of it, not all of it, but trying to write as much as I could while I was doing it, because I wanted to give the book a very immediate feel, almost like a journal of my year, so the readers could feel that they were along on the adventure. And I do that with all of my books. I really try to write them as I'm doing them.
So are each of these books basically a year in your life?
Basically, yes. Yeah. I mean, the health book actually took 2 years of my life, and then I wrote a collection of essays, which were more shorter experiments. Some were like a month or 2 months. So it varies, but that's the general idea.
And what do you do in between books?
I feel lost and unanchored. I like having these structures so that I have something to do, some set mountain to climb. But I work at Esquire, so I write for them. I write features and profiles, and I do have my three kids who are delightful but extremely time consuming, so that takes up a large portion of my day.
How old are your twins now?
My twins are getting old. They're 6 years old now.
Oh, wow.
Mm.
So it's interesting, your book, The Year of Living Biblically, you said you were writing that when the twins were born during that process, and it was published in what year?
A year after, probably 2008.
Okay. And yet you're still getting speaking engagements about that book. Is that unusual for an author to still be getting speaking engagements this long after the book was published?
I actually don't know the market well enough, but I think it's partly because the book struck such a chord with both religious and secular people, in which I feel very lucky, and I was so nervous before the book came out that there would be a backlash, because people would think, oh, you're making fun of the Bible, you're being flippant, or, you know, this is terrible. But I think people saw that I really went in not to make fun of the Bible, but to try to understand it. And so I have gotten a lot of these speaking engagements at synagogues, at churches, at religious colleges. It's nice that people can have a sense of humor about the Bible and realize you can take it, you can look at it humorously, but still take it very seriously.
Now, did you focus just on the Old Testament, or was it both the Old and the New?
Both of them. I mean, I originally was going to do half and half, but I became so immersed in the Old Testament, partly because I'm Jewish and partly because I was following the rules. And
there's a lot more rules in the Old Testament.
There's a lot more rules in the Old Testament. So I kind of got, if I were going to do it again, I might even split it up into two books because I feel I didn't spend enough time on the New Testament.
What did you do when you ran into contradictions?
Well, I would try both strategies, you know. So I would try an eye for an eye, and I would try turn the other cheek and see how each of them felt. And I also spent a lot of time, I wasn't doing this alone. I had a board of spiritual advisors. So I had rabbis and ministers and priests. And I would talk to them about how to, reconcile the different parts of the Bible, which is sometimes possible and sometimes not possible. There's a great quote from Ned Flanders on The Simpsons. He says, "But God, I'm trying to follow all the parts of the Bible, even the parts that contradict the other parts."
when you're coming to speak to Iowa Wesleyan, do you have a theme to what you're wanting to say, what you're wanting people to get out of this book? Is there an underlying message?
I talk about the process of writing the book, but I do talk about what I've learned, sort of the takeaways of what I learned, and one of them I mentioned earlier was this idea of gratitude, but there are several others, the idea of ritual as well, the idea that that you cannot take the Bible completely literally, or you'll end up acting crazy with this huge beard and throwing rocks at adulterers, which I did, by the way. I used very small, like, pebbles.
All right, okay, we got to go into that a little more. How exactly did you identify the targets of your rock throwing?
Yeah, right.
That's a great question, and I had a lot of trouble with that. I only stoned one adulterer, so it happened later in the year, and I was in Central Park in New York, where I live, and this time I was really into character, so I was wearing the robe and the sandals. And the guy came up to me and said, "Why are you dressed like? What's going on?" And I explained, "I'm trying to follow all the rules of the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers." And he says, "Well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that'd be great. That's just what I've been waiting for." So I took out a handful of stones that I had been carrying around for weeks, hoping to run into an adulterer, a self-professed adulterer anyway. And he I showed them to him, and they were very small pebbles, and he was very aggressive. He grabbed the pebbles out of my hand and threw them at my face. So I thought,
oh,
for an eye, I throw one back at him. So that's the way I checked that off my list.
Well, it always bothered me that the woman caught in adultery gets stoned. Where's the man?
That is true. Well, there is a double standard. The man does get stoned in the Bible, but there is a double standard in adultery because men are allowed to sleep with single women. Married men are allowed to sleep with single women. That is not called adultery. But if a man sleeps with another married woman, that is adultery. So, the Bible was written, it was a long time ago, and it's very interested in some forms of social justice about helping the poor, but a lot of it is quite sexist.
Now, AJ, I'm also curious about how you dealt with the various dietary restrictions in the Bible. They're pretty intense.
Oh, yes. Well, there is, the Bible says you can't eat pork and shellfish, so I had to get rid of that. Also, it says you cannot eat eagles or hawks or albatrosses.
You probably didn't.
That put a crimp in my diet.
Mm.
It does, interestingly, say that you can. There is a loophole. You cannot eat most bugs, but locusts and crickets are allowed. So I thought I should at least try a locust. So I got a chocolate covered cricket and had that.
That's probably because John the Baptist ate those, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And some Bible explicators say it's because, if It's a very practical rule. If your crops are overrun by locusts, you have nothing to eat except the locusts. So it was actually a very logical rule.
Yeah, you know those the plagues that God sent upon the Egyptians. I was reading that the plague of the frogs really stopped everything because they worshipped frogs, and they couldn't step
right
outside their house or they'd step on a frog, and that was, you know, so everything stopped. I mean, it was I found that most interesting.
Wow,
that is interesting. Yeah.
Well, AJ, would you like to read a section from the Year of Living Biblically?
Oh, sure, mm-hmm. I would. Oh, you know what's crazy? I was the part I was going to read was stoning of adulterers. So I better pick another section. If you'll just give me a minute.
Sure.
While I search for it, do you want to ask me anything else while I try to call up something else?
You said you were afraid that you might get some backlash, but mostly you had a very positive response. Were there some situations where people were offended by this book?
Yes, there have been a few. I mean, I would say very small percentage. I feel very blessed, as they say, only like 5%. But I did get a few saying that I wasn't approaching it right, and a few people were rooting for me to become, you know, the Orthodox Jews wanted me to become an Orthodox Jew by the end. Atheists wanted me to become an atheist by the end. And the evangelical Christians wanted me to accept Christ. So I think I disappointed some when I didn't in the end, embrace the fully religious lifestyle.
Now,
even though I sort of became more religious in a sense. Well, I do have, I can read just a bit from the introduction, if you want.
That would be great.
If that works for you.
Sure.
As I write this, I have a beard that makes me resemble Moses, or Abraham Lincoln, or Ted Kaczynski. I've been called all three. It's not a well-manicured, socially acceptable beard. It's an untamed mass that creeps up to my eyeballs and drapes below my neckline. I've never allowed my facial hair to grow before, and it's been an odd and enlightening experience. I've been inducted into a secret fraternity of bearded guys. We nod at each other as we pass on the street, giving a knowing quarter smile. Strangers have come up to me and petted my beard, like it's a Labrador retriever puppy or a pregnant woman's stomach. I've suffered for my beard. It's been caught in jacket zippers and been tugged on by my surprisingly strong 2-year-old son. I've spent a lot of time answering questions at airport security. That's true. I've been asked if I'm named Smith and sell cough drops with my brother. ZZ Top is mentioned at least 3 times a week. Passersby have shouted, "Yo, Gandalf." Someone called me Steven Seagal, which I found curious since he doesn't have a beard. I've battled itch and heat. I spent a week's salary on balms, powders, ointments, and conditioners. My beard has been a temporary home to cappuccino foam and lentil soup. Upset people. Thus far, 2 little girls have burst into tears, and 1 boy has hidden behind his mother. But I mean no harm. The facial hair is simply the most noticeable physical manifestation of a spiritual journey I began a year ago. My quest has been this: to live the ultimate biblical life, or more precisely, to follow the Bible as literally as possible, to obey the 10 commandments, to be fruitful and multiply, to love my neighbor, to tithe my income, but also to abide by the oft-neglected rules, to stone adulterers, to avoid wearing clothes made of mixed fibers, and naturally to leave the edges of my beard unshaven. I am trying to obey the entire Bible without picking and choosing.
Now, I know that as part of your research process, you spent some time with religious groups that are trying to live biblically. Did you find a group that you felt was more true to that than others?
I wouldn't say one is more true than the other, because I think that a lot of the Bible is about interpretation, and you can interpret it in a lot of different ways. But I did find groups that I connected with more. like, I'll give you two examples. One is the Red Letter Christians, which is a fascinating group. They're evangelical, but they're not the typical evangelical. So, for instance, they try to follow what Jesus said as opposed to focusing on other parts of the New Testament, and that's why they're called the Red Letter Christian, because in old Bibles, Jesus' words were written in red letters. So they focus on, they say that so much of Jesus' message was about helping the poor and helping outcasts, and so that's what they focus on. They actually have a brochure that they give out that says, here's what Jesus said about homosexuality, and you open it up, and there's nothing inside. So their message is, you know, focusing on gay marriage is a bit of a red herring. It's going down a path that Jesus might not have wanted to go down. So instead, we should focus on helping and loving our neighbors. So I love that. I also had a very interesting experience with Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn. They have an annual festival where they dance in the streets and dance in these big party rooms, and they also get drunk. That's part of the ritual, is you get drunk and you dance. And I did that, and it was a blast. It was like going to a rave. Not that I go to raves, but religious rave. And it was a real nice lesson in how religion and joy can be linked. Because I tended to focus on the sin and the when an outsider thinks about religion, they see the more stern parts, the guilt and the sin. But there's also quite a bit of joy to be had.
Now, I notice in your bio that the Year of Living Biblically is being developed by Paramount Pictures. Is there actually going to be a movie?
Well, that's all in God's hands, of course. but I would say they are, they've been developing it for years since the book came out. And Hollywood is a weird place because all the stars have to align for something to be made into a movie, literally and figuratively. And right now it's actually switched over to being a television show. It's being developed as a TV show. But I'm not holding my breath. I'm cautiously optimistic.
And any idea who would be playing you?
Well, they've gone through all sorts of actors and throwing around names like Ben Stiller. At one point, there was an actor named Marlon Wayans who was attached to play me. And I don't know if you know what Marlon Wayans looks like and what I look like, but we're not total dead ringers for each other. But I met with him, and I thought he was fascinating. He grew up a Jehovah's Witness, and he had some really interesting insights. Eventually, that never worked out, so who knows?
Well, Ben, I could see Ben Stiller or Steve Carell, maybe.
Yeah, I'd love either one of them.
Yeah, yeah. There was someone else that came to mind, but a really funny guy. Oh, Jim Carrey?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think. I think that they were approached, or they expressed interest. It's weird, because when in Hollywood, you know, if there's a project that's announced, everyone expresses interest. All the agents call and say, oh, Jim Carrey loves this project. And then eventually all evaporates.
And how involved are you in the development? Or are you just sort of watching from the sidelines?
Well, weirdly, for that one, it depends on the project. So some I'm involved in and some I'm just on the sidelines. That one, the first script writer came and hung out with me for a month while I was doing the book. They optioned the idea before I'd even written the book.
And wow.
Came and hung out with me. So that was a funny experience.
So have you had any of your works actually made it to the film yet? Made it to film?
I have. Well, one was, I wrote a book called My Life as an Experiment, and it was about a series of experiments I did that were shorter, like a month long. I did one where I outsourced my life. I hired a team of people in Bangalore, India, to do everything for me. Emails and answered my phones. And they argued with my wife for me. So that was fantastic. So I wrote a book with a collection of essays like that, and that was optioned as a sitcom by NBC. And what they do in TV is they make a pilot, and they actually hire actors and film it, and then about a third of the pilots actually make it onto TV. So they made a pilot. They spent tons of money building a townhouse and where I lived, and they made like a fake office for where I worked, and they hired great actors. Donald Sutherland was my father-in-law, and they filmed this, and then it never aired. So my wife and I have the what we consider the most expensive home movie in history.
Okay, so was, who played you in that one?
That it was a little-known comedian named John Doerr, who is hilarious. He's a Canadian guy. He had a beard, which unrelated to the Bible book, but the network actually these things hinge on such ridiculous. Ridiculous little details, but the network did not like his beard, and they couldn't seem to get over that.
Oh, and who played your wife, and was she happy with how she was portrayed?
My wife was delighted that she was played by an actress named Paget Brewster, who was on Criminal Minds, and she was on Friends. And my wife is very happy. She's very pretty, and she has. And the actress has very big boobs, so I think Julie, my wife, was excited about that as well.
Well, it must be, you know, when you got married, did your wife know she was signing up to be food for a comedy?
Great question. She did not. She says that I definitely put the bait and switch on her. She knew I was quirky, but I didn't know that this was going to be part of it. And, you know, I think she's got mixed feelings. Some parts she loves, and readers write in all the time saying how much they love her. Oh, St. Julie. I did a benefit for literacy that was hosted by Barbara Bush and George H.W. Bush, the elder Bushes, and Barbara Bush said to my wife, "You are a saint," and my wife loves that she got a former first lady to call her a saint. So there are advantages.
Do you? There must be things though about your personal life that you deliberately leave out of the book. Books.
It's true. My wife does have veto power, so sometimes she strikes sections. Not that often, though. She did strike in the new book. She took out a passage on our sex life, which I think is actually a good idea. I think probably better off without that.
Probably.
Well, now as your children grow and reach teenage years, you'll have a wealth of material to write about.
Are you speaking from experience, Mom?
Yes, I'm speaking from experience.
So let's turn to your new book, Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. It says, on the back cover, it says, hospitalized with a freak case of tropical pneumonia and ashamed of a middle-aged body best described as a python that swallowed a goat, A.J. Jacobs felt compelled to change his ways and get healthy. To accomplish this epic task, he consulted an army of experts and subjected himself to dozens of different workouts, diets, and devices, from finger fitness to stroller size sessions, veganism to extreme chewing. This is the ultimate self-help health book.
That's it. I tried to do everything to see what worked and what didn't.
And it
was a fascinating year. I loved the experience. It was painful at times, but fascinating.
Did you improve your health?
I did. I don't no longer look like a snake that swallowed a goat, and all the markers went in the right direction, and I have much more energy than I used to.
What habits that you developed during the year of writing this book have carried forward for you?
One of the big ones is the idea of trying not to sit at my desk all day, because the studies are really quite alarming on how bad it is to be sedentary for, you know, 12, 14 hours a day. So I actually took it to the extreme, which I don't think people need to do, but I bought a treadmill, and I put my computer on top of the treadmill, and I wrote the book while walking. So it took me about 1,000 miles to write the book, and I still do that. I still am on my treadmill most of the day, walking and writing, and I love it. It actually keeps me alert, and so far I haven't, you know, fallen off and hurt my head. And I am not very coordinated, so if I can do that, then I think other people can. That's one of the big changes I've made.
I'm trying to picture that and how you actually can type while you're walking.
Yeah, well, you're not running, you're not sprinting, okay. But you're just walking at a leisurely pace, and it's actually quite easy. As I say, I'm not very coordinated, and I can do it. And I am not the only one with this treadmill desk. It's kind of a trend, and they're starting to do like little news segments about it, because there are a lot of people who now either have standing desks or going all out and putting their desk onto a treadmill. And you can buy a pre-made treadmill desk. I made my own. But
oh, wow.
Bye.
That's pretty cool. Would you like to read something from Drop Dead Healthy?
Sure.
Yes.
Give me 1 second to call it up. And,
okay. While you're doing that, let me
again,
ask.
Did you have anything?
How did you structure this book? It looks like you did sort of went body part by body part.
That's right.
Now,
exactly.
It could have been a very different structure. How'd you choose that one?
Well, I wanted to. I think the health is all about different parts of the body. You know, it's not just about diet, not just about exercise, but it's about stress and about sleep and even something of as unexpected as hearing and noise. So I did a section on the ears. And it was surprising because loud noise, we live in the loudest society ever, and loud noise is bad not just for your hearing, but it's also bad for your heart, because what happens is when there's a loud noise, it activates our fight-or-flight syndrome, and it sort of raises our blood pressure, and you do this enough, and it actually has an effect, and there's lots of studies to say that loud noises actually lead to heart disease. So it was fascinating to see how different parts of the body had an effect on the health.
Wow.
I've called it up. I'll just read a little from the introduction
okay.
as well. For the past few months, I've been assembling a list of things I need to do to improve my health. It's an intimidatingly long list, 53 pages to sample. Eat leafy green vegetables. Do 40 minutes of aerobic exercise a day. Meditate several times a week. Watch baseball. Baseball lowers the blood pressure, according to one study. Nap. Napping is good for the brain and heart. Hum. Humming actually prevents sinus infections. Win an Academy Award. I know this is a bit of a long shot, but studies show Oscar winners live 3 years longer than non-Oscar winners. Keep my apartment at 62 degrees, since lower temperatures burn more calories. Buy a potted areca palm, which filters out the dirty air. Become a woman from Okinawa, another long shot, longest life expectancy, and so on and so on. By the way, I printed this list in 9-point papyrus font because I found a study that says that hard-to-read fonts improve your ability to memorize. I want to do everything on my list, because my quest isn't just to be a little healthier. My quest isn't to lose a couple of pounds. My quest is to turn my current self, a mushy, easily winded, moderately sickly blob, into a paragon of health and fitness, to become as healthy as humanly possible. That's how the book starts.
So, which... this, like I said, this book, you've structured it body part by body part. It seems like the year of living biblically was structured chronologically, month by month. How about the other, the Encyclopedia Britannica was A through Z?
Exactly.
So is it
like, as a writer, I really love to have a structure to hang it on. I find that it helps me as a writer, and I think it helps the readers, too, to navigate through.
And in every case, would you say that you've developed the structure before you actually begin?
Actually, yes. In every case, I did. You know, I've been wanting to write this health book for some time, but it's such a big topic, I couldn't figure out how to get a handle on it. And then I was like, well, what if I split it off into different body parts? And that was a breakthrough.
Do you have a favorite chapter in the book?
I do. I think you can't avoid the heart because exercise is so important. And I got to try so many fascinating and bizarre exercise regimens, like doing this caveman workout where I went into Central Park and threw boulders around with a bunch of cavemen. So that was just a lot of fun to do.
Now, I'm just glancing through it. Thank you to your publisher for getting these books to me so quickly. And these are published by Simon & Schuster, which is a very...
very prestigious.
Very prestigious publisher.
Yes.
And so I'm looking at the eyes, chapter 25, The Quest to See Better, and there's a picture of you with some funny-looking glasses on. And I have known people who've tried different glasses that were supposed to improve your vision. In fact, there was a company here in Fairfield that promoted that for a time. Did it work?
Well, there was one program that worked, it wasn't improving your vision, but it was improving your hand-eye coordination. So I think you can do that. You cannot those programs that promise that you can do exercises and cure your nearsightedness or farsightedness, that's basically quackery. You cannot do that. But you can improve your hand-eye coordination.
Did you find a lot of quackery in this year of...
Goodness, so much. It was crazy. I mean, and it's really alarming. You would think that, we are living in a scientific age and that people would not be peddling this, but man, there's so much out there.
So when you're out there, particularly someone who has a serious illness, and they're looking at these, they read on the internet about this cure or that cure. It seems like everywhere you turn, there's some miracle cure. How do you judge what is worth trying and what's not? Do you have any advice?
I do. I mean, it is a great question. It's one of the key questions. And I think you've got to look for sources that are credible. And among those that I found were the Mayo Clinic is very solid. There's something called the Cochrane Collaboration, which is really hardcore about evidence-based medicine. So the key is not to look at just one study, but to look at studies that look at hundreds of studies, sort of an aggregation of studies. Because you can always find one study that says, oh, bacon is great for you. Eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You've got to look at the hundreds of studies about the heart and realize, well, actually, that's kind of an outlier. You should not be eating bacon all that often. So, stick to academic institutions. Stick to places like the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic. That's where you'll find evidence-based medicine.
Of course, some people will say, well, they're just trying to keep the real cures away because the medical establishment doesn't want us to be healthy. Have you heard that argument?
Yes, and I think that's, that's sort of crazy conspiracy talk. And almost all the doctors I got to work with and meet really are trying to do their best to cure people and keep the world healthy.
One of the things that I find so kind of funny, but kind of actually I joke around about a lot, but it's also kind of challenging, is that the rules keep changing as to what, in terms of what's good for you and what's not.
Oh yeah, sure.
When I was a kid, butter was bad, margarine was good. and now margarine's bad and butter's good. And eggs.
It's super frustrating.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. But I'll tell you one thing that might make you feel better.
Okay.
Which is that there are these conflicting reports in nutrition. Like you say, butter is good, butter is bad. But 90% of nutrition people agree on, the experts all agree on, and that is if just keeping it really simple, just eating whole foods, not processed foods,
right.
Trying to limit your sugar, not eating too much, limiting your portions, and eating mostly plants. Most experts agree that a really plant-heavy diet is good for you. So if you follow those really basic rules, you're 90% there. And then the stuff around the margins may change, but the majority is just eating whole, solid foods.
And everything in moderation.
Exactly. Including moderation.
Including moderation. So go back to number one on your list of things to do, eat your leafy green vegetables.
So true. But it's basic, but you can't argue with it.
And actually, as I've gotten older, I've actually liked leafy green vegetables.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I experienced that my taste buds changed during my experiment. So I was not so hot on the vegetables, but I just kept forcing myself to eat them. And now, weirdly, I have the same salad every day, and I crave it. I love the taste of my salad, which I never thought would happen.
Wow. Well, congratulations. So, AJ, just we only have a few minutes left, and I just want to talk a little bit more about how you became a writer. You know, we talked about your starting in journalism, but journalism isn't really normally where you build your comedic writing talent. Were you always a funny guy?
Well, when I first started in journalism, I wasn't only doing fun. You know, I was a regular general assignment reporter, so I was writing about, you know, sewage lines and gay meetings, and it wasn't all that funny. But I do love looking at life from a sort of slightly slanted point of view. So I gravitated toward that, and I think there is room for you can do nonfiction, you can tell a great story, and give people information and useful tips, and still make it funny. So, you know, giving them broccoli and bubble gum at the same time.
And how has the changes in the world of publishing, both magazine and book publishing, that are brought about by the new technology, is it impacting you at all?
Sure, it's impacting everyone. And it's it's a confusing time. No one knows what the future's going to be like in 5 years. I like to say that it's creatively one of the greatest times to be a writer, because there's so many outlets, there's so many interesting things you can do with video and text and... but it's also, financially, is one of the most challenging times, because it's getting harder and harder to monetize your writing. People expect things for free.
Do you have a blog?
I do. My website is ajjacobs.com.
And how often do you blog?
I am actually a very intermittent blogger, but I do. I'm on Facebook and Twitter quite a bit, so you can find me there at ajjacobs.
Yeah, if you do all those things, it can end up being a full-time job just in and of itself, and then when do you have time to write your book?
Oh, it's so true. It really is it's a balancing act. Sometimes one of the most important things is just to turn off all technology and just do a deep dive. Otherwise, as you say, you could spend all your time on the social media.
Do you ever write by hand? Like
no,
pencil
do.
And paper?
When I'm generating ideas, I find it helpful to write by hand. When I'm actually writing the text, then I do it on a computer.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and I think I forgot to say this midway through the show. So hopefully you hung on so that you can find out who it is we've been talking to today. AJ Jacobs, the author of Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Health, Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection, and The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. AJ is coming to Iowa next week. He'll be at Iowa Wesleyan March 14th. Do you know what time your presentation is there?
I'm sorry, I don't, but it's on on the website. I know that.
Okay, at ajjacobs.com. And also, if you're here in Fairfield, I know there's an announcement about it in the Fairfield Weekly Reader, and probably in the Mount Pleasant News, too, if you're listening over there. And you can hear our broadcast. If you missed part of it, you can listen Monday morning at 8 a.m.
Right.
And it's also available on the web at KRUUFM.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, AJ. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for wannabe comedic writers?
Well, I think what you said earlier is turn off that internet and lock your cell phone in another room and spend at least an hour a day writing without those distractions. That really is so crucial.
Well, thank you, and I look forward. Hopefully, I'll make it over to Mount Pleasant to see you next week.
I would love it. All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Goodbye. Mom, do you have some parting words of wisdom for our listeners today?
I do. The world seldom notices who the teachers are, but civilization depends on what they do and what they say. Right?
That's right. Thank you for joining us today on Writers' Voices. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore, who will be taking you on a journey through the news and lots of good information and music. It's a very eclectic show. And if you're listening Monday morning, have a great week. See you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.